This is Phil Farron. And I am driving home. It's Friday today. I completely forgot yesterday. I didn't completely forget. I had my notes. I walked out of the door, got to work, and my major client, and thought, I did not bring my recorder. So I've actually finished going grocery shopping with my mom, my dad, and got their bills all taken care of, and yada, yada, yada. And so now we're good. So I'm doing this on the way home from that. Have a few little things to do today, but I'm hoping to get 1,200 or so words down. I just thought, man, there's no way I'm going to reach 7,500 words this week. Because of, I just had some interruptions and, you know, this, that, and the other. And but last night, it started cooking. It's just such an interesting thing because Thursday night, I didn't write at all. Wednesday night, I'm always a little tired on Wednesday nights because that's fast night. So Wednesday night, I made some progress, but really not as much as I should have. Monday night was kind of a struggle. But then, like, last night, it just started opening up. So, you know, you just keep pounding away. You just keep pounding away on it. And eventually, things start loosening up. So, anyways, I did cross 60,000 words, which, in my mind, in my little world, is cool. Because I'm 8 weeks into that, and that 60,000 words represents 7,500 words a week. Yay! And I still have 2 days. Got a lot of graduation thingies I have to go to tomorrow, but I'm hoping to get an early start on the morning, pound out another 1,200 words tomorrow, and then I'll be to my 7,500 words. So, which I usually have Friday scheduled for 1,000 words and Saturday scheduled for 1,250 words. So I'm only trying to get 250 words more than I usually get on Fridays and Saturdays. So I think we'll be okay. I do have to do a cover for my dad. My dad knocked out another book, so I have to do a cover for him. It's the first, so I have to bill. So I do have a few distractions that I got to get rid of as soon as I get home. And I have a mental distraction to get rid of, this project we've been working on, my major client. It is web-based. Turns out, there is a bug, apparently, in Internet Explorer. When you have very large tables, which we do on one of the screens, that sometimes it just doesn't quite render everything correctly. Thank you very much. Supposedly that problem got fixed. I found the problem online in Internet Explorer 9. Supposedly the problem got fixed, but we're still having a problem in 10. So I've got some more work to do on Monday, but it is a recognized problem. So, and there's solutions. And. I keep telling myself the same thing that I told my buddy that I had dinner with on Tuesday night. At the end of the day, there is nothing to fear. You know, you can get yourself all worked up about a bunch of stuff, but at the end of the day, there's nothing to fear. Because, you know, as soon as we have one user who has been reporting this problem, and the large table is actually on the statement that we are displaying for the contractors, the missionaries, who work, you know, who are coming to this site to see their stuff. And you really don't want just pieces of the statement missing, you know, so then there's the, oh, what's going to happen? Oh, you know, but I've already got a couple of ideas that Jesus has given me, so it's good. Jesus talking to us. What a great idea that is. It's just spectacular. I find the only time that I get into trouble is when I don't listen. Even this morning, I listened a little, but I just didn't listen enough. We keep the doors to our bedroom locked because the cats have learned how to open the doors, and, you know, they come in, meow, 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 meow. So, you know, we keep the doors locked. Well, I keep a little door opening key. It's not really a key. It's just this flat piece of metal, because it's not like it's a keyed lock. It's just a push button. And a little flat piece of metal. And I keep it above the door jamb. My wife can't reach it up there, and I accidentally locked her out of the bedroom last night. So after I went to bed, she got in, and she unlocked it, and then she put it someplace else. She put it on top of a hanging mirror. You know, and I went to check the door, and the door was locked, and so I reached above the door where the key was. The key wasn't there. My wife's still sleeping. I'm thinking, oh, man, what am I going to do now? And, you know, and Jesus very clearly told me, well, it's in there. It's in there. The key's in there. And, you know, so I went in and just kind of looked around. I didn't really put my heart into it. If I had put my heart into it, I would have seen the key. But then I knocked on the door, and she came to the door. What? And I said, well, the key is missing. She said, well, I had to move it. I couldn't. You locked me out. I couldn't reach the key. Oh, sorry, sorry. So she said, I put it over there. So, okay, well, that's good. I told her, you know, that's good as place as any. We'll just keep it there. Okay. So she went back to bed. But, you know, Jesus was pointing me in the right direction, and I just ignored it. So, we need to make it our purpose in life not to ignore the voice of God, because life is better. But anyways, I didn't finish up bragging on myself about the book. So, yeah, so I'm already at 60,000 words. I have 2 more weeks before I need to loop back and start working on the second book, getting it ready for production. I have a bunch of Vader readers who have not gotten back to me yet, which is not a good sign. But everybody who's gotten back to me, you know, said, hey, yeah, enjoyed the book, great book, you know. So I, you know, part of it may be that the book ends well. It ends well. So, you know, if it drags a little bit in the middle, as long as it ends well, by the time people get to that, then they kind of forget, because that's the last thing in the book. And it does end well. I landed it. It's a good ending. It really is. I like that ending a lot. So I've done 2 now. I only have to do 22 more of those kinds of endings. But step at a time. I think I know what the epilogue is going to be on this book. And it may be shorter, but it should be touching. And it looks like the current book I'm working on, The Narrow Door, is going to have a little sweet spot in the middle of it. So that'll be a little surprise for readers, because these books haven't had that. But it'll be a little, hey, ding, there it is. Anyway, so that all is well. My wife is ramping up for the children's musical, Good Kings Come in Small Packages. It's interesting because she did this same musical like 17 years ago or something like that. And the kids that she had in her choir then are now, of course, all grown up and moving on to other things. It's an amazing thing to watch all that. This week, just kind of a follow-on with something that I talked about several weeks ago, because I saw another article on it. And I got to tell you, I almost pitched away these notes and tried to find something else. But, you know, it's an interesting thing to track. And I frankly am not exactly sure how I feel about this. I know how I'm supposed to feel about this. But I'm not sure how I actually feel about this. And if my response to this might be, yeah, why not? So I came across an article that was titled Ready for the Marriage Apocalypse. And it's pretty interesting. The correspondent's name was Carol Costello. And she said, you know, she's been talking to millennials. And she said, if you talk to many millennials, the people who were born, I think millennials came of age at the turn of the millennium. So it's anybody who's born, or in the first decade, I think it's anybody who's born in the late, mid-80s, 90s, in through there. She said, if you talk to them, the picture that you begin to see is an America that is virtually marriage-free, with everyone happily single, which is kind of interesting. She said she went back and talked to a bunch of journalism students at her alma mater, Kent State University. And she said, I wanted to pick their brains about politics and religion and marriage. And she said their views on marriage really intrigued her the most. And she said, because guess what? They don't care what your generation thinks. They'll get married if and when they want. Which, you know, like I said, I'm not really sure how I feel about this. I mean, one of the gals said, look, I didn't go to college for 4 years to become a mom. She said, there's no housewife degree. She said, I worked my butt off for 4 years to get this degree. I want to use it. I want to be successful, and I want to have that happy part of my life as well. And another gal said, I would have a very hard time justifying spending $20,000 on a wedding when I could go to Europe. Well, okay, that, you know, that makes sense. And she said, at first, I thought she was joking. So she said, I jokingly responded, wow, some people would say that with that attitude, you're undermining the moral foundation of the country. She said, and Jackie didn't even blink. She said, but Europe, she explained. I'm really looking for a travel buddy. I don't think you need a wedding ring to prove that you love somebody. I see a lot of people getting married too soon or staying together or are unhappy because they are afraid to be alone. Ah, now, that's actually a very, very good observation. And I would rather be alone, successful, and happy than in a relationship where I'm not happy. I'm okay being single forever as long as I'm happy. Okay. You know, some people would berate her for being narcissistic. But, you know, the millennials, I mean, they're coming from a kind of an interesting place because what they've seen growing up is a culture that is riddled with divorce. You know, she quotes a statistic in this article that 42 million of adults have been married more than once, and that's me included. That's up 22 million from 1980 and 14 million from 1960. She said, percentage-wise, that means among adults who are currently married, roughly a quarter have been married before, compared with 13% in 1960. So, I mean, our generation that gave birth to the millennials and raised the millennials, we don't have that great a track record with marriage. And frankly, when I look around, I was talking to a buddy about this week. When I look around at what we have in marriage, even in the church, I don't see true partnerships. I don't even see, most of the time, relationships where people are truly being real with each other. Because they've learned over time they really can't be. You know, they really just, it's not, it's not really prudent to be honest with your partner because they're just going to get upset and then you're going to have to deal with that upset, you know, for weeks, months, years to come. And so you just sort of settle in to this maintenance where, you know, you're really good friends and you enjoy spending time with each other, which that's a blessing, because I've been in another marriage where, you know, we weren't really friends and it was much more difficult. But in terms of really being open and honest with each other, you know, you just kind of say, well, you know, let's just do what we got to work with. And I think there is a real principle with marriage of realizing that your marriage relationship is not what you imagine it to be in your mind. Your marriage relationship will be the relationship that it is possible for the two of you to build together. And I think that process is a very valuable process. Learning to build a life together is a wonderful thing to do. You know, but in terms of young people who are saying, look, I don't want to get married unless I'm happy. I'm backing into my garage. I don't want to get married unless I find the right person. I don't need to get married. I'm only going to get married if I really, really find the right person. I mean, I don't know that there's anything wrong with that necessarily. I mean, good for them. You know, good for them that they're not rushing off to get married because they're afraid. I think that's a lot of what happened with a lot of marriages. People didn't want to be alone, and so then they just found somebody who seemed like they were okay. But of course, all of us are trying to put on our best faces when we're in that dating mode. And if what's really being driven at the bottom of it is either men just wanting to have sex and, you know, it's just so difficult to get out there, or women who just don't want to be alone because they're afraid, you know, then they pair up and everybody's on their best behavior for a while. Well, that type of relationship is not the greatest relationship in the world. You can learn to love each other. You can, you know, but I can see that, yeah, it would be better if you just waited till get married until you found absolutely the right person. And this reporter actually asked these young people, so how many of you want to be married by the time you're 25? And nobody raised their hand. How many? 28, 30. Well, a few hands started going up. So if the young people of today, or, and I put in that group people who are graduating from college because I am old, if they want to wait till they're 30 or 35 to get married, great. That's just fine. There's some interesting quotes in this. A study sponsored by the Conservative American Enterprise Institute says, from an obvious standpoint, households with two adults are likelier to have two incomes and improve well-being. On the other hand, the study points out that people who have money may be more desirable marriage prospects. She said, bingo on that point. The millennials I talked with prefer their parents to be debt-free and riding high. They also don't want to burden a husband or wife with their own debt. One of the gals said, right now I'm 21 years old. I'm thousands of dollars in debt. That wasn't something my parents bore. It's really hard to plan a wedding or even think about something like that when you owe so much money. You don't have a job and you don't have a home. You know, good for her. Good for her that she's actually saying, this is my responsibility. I'm the one who put myself in debt, and I'll dig myself and, you know, out of it. And what's interesting is you start looking at some other countries, and in other countries, you find that they're kind of ahead of us on the curve. She said Scandinavians are just about there, according to USA Today. In Norway, 82% of couples have their first child out of wedlock. The numbers are similarly high in Sweden and Denmark. While many couples marry after their first or second child, it's clear that marriage in parts of Scandinavia is dying. The article also points out Norway ranked first and Sweden second in the United Nations Quality of Life Survey, which rates per capita income, education levels, health care, life expectancy, and measuring a nation's well-being. The USA came in eighth. Um, So he said, to put it short, there's an effort to understand the joys of sambo, the term for living together in Scandinavia. My producer researched, reached out to Michael Enstav Edler, a 35-year-old man from Stockholm, Sweden. To put it short, he told us marriage costs money, party clothes, rings, honeymoon trip, gives no significant advantages. There is no economic or legal advantages, no real social pressure to get married, or anyone frowning on premarital sex or cohabitation. Okay, well, I don't think the United States is quite there yet, but, you know, we're definitely getting here. Another lady from Sweden said, the notion that marriage is something that you're pressured into seems horrible to me. Marriage should be for love, no matter a matter of expectations, routine. Oh, not a matter of expectations, routine, or everyday practices. And the Kent State millennials that the author was talking to agreed with that. They said, marriage is about love. It's not about planning or timing. And that's what we're all kind of waiting for. You know, I have a hard time disagreeing with that marriage should be about love. Now, I do think if you're gonna have children, that I think it's better for children to be married, to have this establishment of a covenant. I think that gives the children a sense of permanence. So the author said, which brings me back to the idea of a pending marriage apocalypse. Would it be so terrible if we all remained single? If I had remained single, I thought about it. So did my husband. We didn't plan to have children. What was the point? In the end, we made a decision based on love and practicality. A commitment would not only prove our love, but also force us to get through the bad times couples are sure to endure. 11 years later, we have no regrets. We are not you and yours, but we are not you and yours. Would a society without marriage be just as well off as one filled with I do's? Okay, and you know, there's a lot of interesting stuff in that. And I think, I guess for me, I have to say that I'm not sure of the value of having people commit to marriage if the only reason that they're committing to marriage is because they're afraid of not being married. I don't think that's a good idea. But unfortunately, what I don't see in the Church of Jesus Christ is while I think true Christianity has some really profound things to say about marriage, and while I think it has truly some profound things to teach us about God and his relationship with us, that you can really learn no other way besides being married to somebody and, you know, being committed to them and day in and day out having to just deal with the grind that sometimes goes along with being married, and really coming to what the relationship is, not what I fantasize about it being, but what really we can attain as a marriage couple. As a married couple, there's just so much good that can come out of being married. But if we as the church, as we as followers of Jesus Christ, aren't really teaching that stuff, and we're sort of relying on the fact that guys want to have a steady sex partner and gals don't want to be alone and they're afraid to be alone, if we're relying on this fear and lust to somehow gin up a continuing commitment to marriage, I don't think that's the right path for us to go at all. I think that we have a strong case to make for marriage, to make it make sense, to say this is something that you all can experience and learn from that you can't any other way, and it will help you each become your best. There's so much to commend marriage, but it's certainly not, oh, you just get to have a steady sex partner, or, oh, you won't have to be afraid and alone anymore. But unfortunately, from what I see within the organized Church of Jesus Christ, a lot of times that's just kind of our fallback supposition. Well, of course you want to get married. even though we don't ask the questions why. And so it's really fascinating to me to see that we've got a generation that's coming up and is asking the questions why. And, you know, I would just hope that we would have the actual answers to respond to them, because we actually do have answers that we can give them. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.